Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, how you doing today?
I'm very well, Mark.
So happy to hear it. I know today we're going to be talking about a complicated topic, the economic side of EB5 and how confusing it can be.
Yes, Mark. Economics is really very, very central to EB5, especially if we are using the Regional Center Program. And there is so much confusion about this. That's why we thought it would be a good idea to really try and demystify this whole area.
That's right. It is very confusing. And with regional centers, part of the strength of a regional center is the ability to use some of these economic analysis and the way some of the economics work within a regional center. And that's why, Mona, I know you and I are very excited to have today on the show Kimberly Atterbury. Kim is the president of Vermilion Consulting, LLC. Vermilion helps varied organizations in the public and private sectors leverage the benefits of the EB5 program. Kim and her team provides expert advice on project feasibility, EB5 compliance structure, job creation methodology, and targeted employment area analysis. And Mona, I don't know if you knew this, but Kim was also the chief economist at USCIS.
Well, I'm really happy that you're able to be on this show, Kim. It is a real honor for us. But tell us a little bit about Vermilion, from USCIS to Vermilion. How did that happen?
Well, it was kind of a natural progression. Prior to working for USCIS, I owned my own consulting business for many, many years. I worked for USCIS for 2 years, and that was a very interesting and professionally expanding experience. But the traffic of D.C. does weigh upon people, and it did on me. So in 2011, I decided to leave the government and go back to my own independent consulting. Having been inside of USCIS and working in the EB5 unit, partially, that wasn't all that I did there, I got to see the good, the bad, and the ugly, and a lot of the bad and the ugly, actually, as far as economic analysis and general submission quality. And so I decided to add to my consulting practice an EB5 element, which has kind of taken over the entire consulting practice at this point.
Well, I'm not surprised. But Kim, that was a difficult time. I mean, back in those days, I think that not only I know ourselves that we had been given reports from different clients, from economists who really didn't know what they were doing, who had no understanding of EB5. And I don't even know if they were real economists, quite frankly. It was a difficult time. And I think that things have really, you know, come together a little bit with USCIS today.
You're absolutely right. And there's a reason that it wasn't a great time. It's what makes EB5 so difficult. There is no textbook that guides this industry, not for what I do and really not for what you do. So we're all working together to try to figure out what it is USCIS really wants to see and what makes a good submission. And so that's really what we focused our EB5 practice on, is providing a submission that's not every piece of paper we can think to put in the back of a business plan or economic analysis, but really is targeted at providing the specific information that USCIS needs to see to make an informed decision about a project.
Yeah. Well, we have some very kind of, I would call them basic questions, but I have to admit that for the first few years when I first started practicing EB5 and I would see economist report, my eyes would glaze over most of it. And I would just pray that, okay, let's hope they get these right and just edit it for a few of the pointers. But there are a lot of attorneys who listen to our program, as well as investors, who really want to understand a little bit more about some of the nuances relating to the economic side of it. one of the important questions that a lot of investors worry about is if they are the last to come into a project, what does that mean to them? Does that mean they really shouldn't go into that project? Is it more risky because they're the end, the tail end?
That's a great question. I also have had that question from a lot of sectors. My response to that would be really that any investor should be very aware of how many jobs a project's going to create, how many investors are going to be in that project, and what the timeline for job creation is. And a good economics report will tell you that. The best EB-5 projects don't leave job creation to chance. They maintain a significant buffer to protect investors, all investors. So that, you know, it's really kind of a personal decision for each investor as to, you know, what level of job creation they feel comfortable with overall. But one of the things I usually recommend is that investors or attorneys request a mini job creation report update as the investor goes along, and then they will better understand where they fall in the job creation timeline, and then they'll know when their jobs have been created.
So, Kim, let me ask you this. When you say a buffer, I know that you need to create 10 jobs for every EB-5 investor. When you say buffer, you're saying projects should look to create, you know, 12, 15, perhaps 20 jobs or more per investor. Is that essentially what you're saying?
That's correct. And while there is no USCIS requirement that you create more jobs, it does make sense because things happen in projects. There's this thing called value engineering. You know, and for years I heard developers always say, oh, no project comes in under budget. Well, guess what? Value engineering, that's what they do. So projects can come in under budget. And so what happens if they do? Or other things can happen. Revenues might not hit the forecast. Something could happen in the overall economy. So it makes sense. And it's really very project dependent.
I see. Mona, when you were asking about jobs accounted as the first jobs that come in are attributed to the first investors. So if you don't have that buffer, the last investors may be out of luck.
Right. Because there are so many projects out there now where they advertise, we only have 8 slots left or 5 slots left or 3 slots left. Attorneys who don't really understand what's going on with the whole economic analysis, but they do understand that you should be advising your client not to be the last one in, they take it very rigidly and they will say, no, don't go to that project. There's only 3 spots left. We do have to look at that there if there's a buffer or not. And then there's always a situation that Kim will definitely understand this, that the project has already started. They're halfway through. They're using a bridge loan. They want to count all the jobs that they've already counted before they've even started EB-5. And USCIS are starting to give us a bit of a hard time on projects like this. So it's very difficult for an investor to decide whether they should go into a project where construction hasn't begun at all or whether construction has half begun. You know, the risks on both sides as far as adjudication is concerned.
That's right. And adjudications can shift over time. And with the, you know, the length of the adjudication timeline, that also presents a problem because the way USCIS sees things might change during that time. And that makes it very hard for the investors.
Kim, I'm going to ask you a question on an area which we are seeing to be more and more common. And that's when an entrepreneur or a standalone project, or maybe some two friends together, not a regional center project, are using a regional center model, meaning that they are using, that's their own project, but they don't feel that they either have enough jobs or the jobs are indirect jobs, so they're going and renting a regional center. Would you require an economic report for a situation like that?
If they are using a regional center and they hope to use any jobs other than those direct full-time qualifying jobs, then yes, they should go ahead and get the economic report. I know that it represents an additional cost, but it really makes a lot of sense because there are a lot more jobs than the people working in an organization. And economic modeling really is a great way to get at those jobs. And the documentation is also quite a bit easier when you use modeling practices.
But sometimes it doesn't make sense, Kim. If, for example, we have four or five friends pooling together to buy a hotel, and the hotel's only about 7 million, but we have to produce 40 to 50 jobs, you utilize the expenditure model. How could we, you know, get enough jobs? How could we get enough jobs in such a situation? Would you mix direct jobs with the expenditure model?
Well, there's a couple of ways. Economic modeling allows you to use a variety of different inputs. And so when we look at modeling a project, we look at two sides of it. First is the development side, if there is one. So building, developing the hotel. And then the other side is operating the hotel. So on the development side, you would look at expenditures, construction expenditures, any qualified development expenditures can be used to calculate construction phase impacts. On the other side, operational impacts can be calculated a couple of different ways. One, the most common, would be to use operational revenues once the operation is up and going. But we could use direct jobs to estimate the operational impacts as an input to the model. That is not done quite as often, tends to have not as good of job creation results as using operational revenue.
Yeah.
And the documentation is a little more difficult at the 829, but it can be done.
So, Kim, it sounds like the money that is either generated or spent essentially creates jobs that, well, aren't directly tied to the project. Maybe they're indirect or induced jobs, or I don't know the nomenclature. You're the economist, not me. But it sounds like whether it's the operating revenue after this particular project is running or the actual people that operate in it, those can basically attribute to other jobs that aren't directly with the project. I'm essentially restating what you just said, but let me ask this. Is there a particular, I'll almost say magic bullet, but is there something that each dollar spent creates more jobs within the economic model than something else? Is it something within the building or something within the operating? Is it some activity that says for every dollar spent here, it creates more jobs than other things in the economic model?
Well, it's more of in the economy. So, for instance, if we're looking at operational revenue for a hotel, that's just one industry.
Mm-hmm.
But you could, depending on different projects, we would look at operational revenue for leasing retail space or operating a manufacturing plant or building a ship. Any of these different activities would have a significantly different impact on the overall economy.
Okay, that's actually a better answer to my question. Because I was basically saying, you know, what could it, what's the magic activity that would create the most jobs? And what you said, you answered it correctly to my bad question. And you're saying, well, each project depends. Obviously, there's a project that generates revenue. That's what the project is. But those have different, essentially, multipliers for jobs. So thank you for a better answer to my not so great question. Thanks, Kim.
And that also leads me to the question, Kim, when and where and how and why would we have an economic report? I suppose we should have started with that, but I thought it made sense in this context because after this, we're going to go to the big elephant in the room.
Well, there's a number of times when you would want an economic report, and there's several different times in the EB-5 immigration life cycle that you might produce a different, slightly different type of economic report. They are used for 924 exemplars for projects. They're used for investors' 526 filings, annual 924A filings for regional centers, and also importantly for the 829 filings.
So you would use a separate one for an 829 filing, even though you have a project report, you have an economic report for the 526 filing?
You could use a separate one for the 829 filing. And a lot of my clients actually do that.
Yeah, we have a good, in our practice, we do that also. But I've seen cases where they haven't.
That's right. And sometimes, based on my time back at USCIS, when we were talking about not all economic reports were the greatest, but some of those were approved. And so many of them become difficult at the 829 with some of those older, less compliant reports, you're trying to figure out, how do I communicate that this really did create the jobs to USCIS? And so you kind of have to bridge the gap between what was previously approved, but what USCIS understands now, because there are different people adjudicating them today.
That's right. And we're finding that some methodologies are just not being accepted. I think USCIS really want to sort of streamline the way all of this is put together. Okay, the big elephant in the room, Mark. Mm-hmm. What everybody's been talking about nonstop for the last 2 years, TEA.
Target employment areas, exactly, because they can be different things depending on who's looking at it, right?
Right. That as well. And of course, Kim, the big question, how can a buzzing, vibrant, job sort of plentiful place like Manhattan be a TEA?
That is the question everybody's asked. Well, urban unemployment can change drastically from city block to city block. There are sections in every urban area that have pockets of unemployment. And in Manhattan, much of that unemployment is north of Central Park. There's been much outrage that any part of Manhattan could be a TEA based on unemployed people that live in the northern end of the island.
Yeah.
And typically, economists define an unemployed person as someone who is willing, able, and available to work. And so it's my belief that any unemployed person that lives on the north end of Manhattan would be more than willing to ride the subway or take a bus to the south end of the island, 13 miles away, for a job. And I will say that most commuters travel in the U.S. 15 miles one way to work. So that's me saying I don't get outraged by TEAs that stretch the length of Manhattan, but many people do.
There's lots of arguments about that. I mean, that's really a topic for another day. But people do want to understand how it could be a TEA, because they've always have felt that Manhattan has taken the advantage over other states and cities. What is the difference, Kim, between an urban TEA and a rural TEA?
Well, currently, the rural TEA, it's very specific. And you definitely have to do some research to make sure. You can't just say, I'm standing in a field, and so this must be a rural TEA. Rural means, in the EB-5 context, that the county is outside of any county included in a metropolitan statistical area, and also outside of the boundaries of any town with a population of 20,000 people or more. And so it is very important. And if I could, I'd just like to give you a quick example.
Sure.
Crosby County, Texas, it's in the panhandle of Texas. It has a population of barely over 6,000 people in the entire county, but it's not rural because it is one of the counties included. Yeah, it's included in the Lubbock, Texas MSA. So it's really important to know what's rural and what's not. Urban TEAs are simply based on high unemployment levels that are typically calculated by aggregating census tracts or census block groups.
So, Kim, you're saying the Metropolitan Statistical Area, the MSA, if it already has that county or that location as a part of that defined Metropolitan Statistical Area, and that isn't a rural area, then unfortunately you can't use the rural rules. Say that three times fast. But with regard to TEAs in urban areas, it sounds like it's just an amalgamation of census tracts. And am I correct in assuming that the project creators are the ones that choose those census tracts for the amalgamation to find out if it is in a TEA or not?
Each state has its own requirements for aggregating census tracts together to create a high unemployment, targeted unemployment area. And it is important to understand the particular state's requirements and follow their data set. Each state has its own data set. And in Texas, that's also each city and county has its own data set and requirements. So there's 1,000 different requirements for calculating an urban TEA, depending on where you are.
Well, the importance really of the rural TEA is really starting to come out with some of the proposals in the new legislation. because I'm not sure whether you're aware of this, Mark. I'm sure Kim was aware. There is going to be a rural carve-out, meaning that, well, basically what happens is most investors, they don't want to have a project in anywhere rural. If you actually even give it to them, they would much rather put their money in the cities. And to really encourage people to come into these areas and stimulate the economy, which is what, you know, the whole 500 and 1 million TEA designation was all about, I think the government really have to give them some sort of additional stimulus. So under the legislation, the new proposed legislation, there's a rural carve-out allowing additional visas for anyone who goes into these areas.
So is that additional to the 10,000 EB-5 visa cap, or is that just a carve out of that 10,000?
It's a carve out of the 10,000.
Or whatever that number may be after they redo this new legislation, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But it will be, obviously, the countries that it really does affect are countries like China and other countries which might fall into retrogression after this year. We're looking at Vietnam and probably India. So countries like that will just be able to go into the rural areas and have a visa available. Again, this is just proposition. It's not law yet.
Right. But it sounds like it's going that way, and that it may be a way to not get around, but really work within the retrogression, because you've got this carve out that's not affected by the retrogression until, well, that carve out gets full. But with the way people have been investing, they haven't been going after the rural areas. This may be an incentive to do so.
Yes, actually, when you use the word retrogression, it reminds me, Kim, I forgot to ask you, in my earlier questions about first come, first served, what happens to the Chinese who are in retrogression?
Well, that is also a good question, and we're asked about that a lot. And it's one of those occasions where investors might benefit from using those expenditure and revenue inputs rather than the direct job inputs, just from the perspective of making sure job creation is done early on, because investors that are affected by retrogression won't be filing an 829 for a really long time. And so if I were in that position, I would want to be making sure that the jobs were coming along while I was waiting in line. And so I would say in that case, it's really important for investors to stay on top of the documentation to make sure that they have all the appropriate evidence that they need when they finally do get to their retrogression, get through retrogression and get to their 829 milestone.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. That sounds complex. That sounds like fourth dimensional, ninth dimensional math there with retrogressions, right, and old visa approvals and that removal of conditions and different economic analysis. Wow, that's very hard to unpack in a simple response. But thank you, Kim.
Mark, we must have Kim come back and explain all of the new designation rules once it's become a final.
That would be great. It would also be great to have things final.
Well, I was going to tell you, I've been editing potential legislation in EB-5 since 2009. So if we did actually see something get passed, that would be a miracle.
Well, in 2015, I know we on the Public Policy Committee at IIUSA, I think we spent hours and hours going over the legislation and the donut rules and the non-donut rules, etc. I hope it's not all a waste of time. I do hope the legislators did take our points and comments into account.
Right, exactly. Yes. Well, you know, Mona, we have some time left on this episode. And since we have Kimberly Atterbury, the former chief economist of USCIS, in fact, when she went in, she was the only economist, and she single-handedly built a team and a process around that. And since we are coming up to the new designations and rules and everything with economic analysis and TEAs, Mona, I know you have a tool that you would like to give Kim right now. You're laughing. Go ahead. Present that tool to Kim and present her the challenge.
Kim, I'm going to offer you my magic wand. My magic wand will allow legislators and USCIS officials to listen to your wish. You have one wish. What would you like?
I would like to see whatever TEA process comes about be very simple, very straightforward, use a single data set that everybody can work from the same page and know when they put together a TEA that it will be acceptable, not just to USCIS, but also to our legislators, that it will be achieving that what they feel it needs to achieve.
That's a tall order, Kim.
That is. It's also a very selfless order, because the complexity of all these rules right now is essentially why economists like Kim and her group at Vermilion Consulting obviously get so much work, because it is complicated and it allows you to do some things. So, Kim, thank you. That was a very selfless wish.
Well, I just do think it would be good for the industry overall. And that's not really one of those things that we should be questioning. And we should know what it is. These are the rules. We're going to follow the rules. And that makes it much more straightforward for everyone. And I'll find other ways to make up that income.
There you go. I love that. An abundance mentality. And Kimberly Atterbury, you certainly have an abundance mentality. Thank you so much for coming on EB5 Investment Voice.
Thank you both. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw and Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.